I have one thing to teach. The Buddha is reputed to have said, dukkha and the cessation of dukkha. And that's really kind of remarkable because unlike Jesus, who, as far as we know, had at most 3 years and more likely only 1 year to share his teachings, the Buddha lived for about 40 years after his enlightenment experience, so he said a lot of things. There are thousands of Buddhist scriptures, and yet the Buddha is supposed to have said, I have only really taught one thing, dukkha and the cessation of dukkha, which means that's got to be pretty important. So for those who aren't familiar with the Buddha's story, briefly put, at the time of his birth, it is said that there was a prophecy that he would either grow up to be the greatest king there had ever been or the greatest holy man. Since his father was a king, his dad wanted him to follow in his footsteps and did everything he could to make sure that Siddhartha had no spiritual leanings at all. Like a lot of us here. No. Sorry. So what he did was to make sure that every desire of the Buddha's, of the Siddhartha's life, for his name was Siddhartha Gautama, that every desire of his life was met. Anything he wanted, he had. And anything that might be distressful was removed from his sight. So he grew up thinking that life was pretty good. In fact, that life is pretty perfect. But because this is a religious myth, that won't last for long. And so one day he decides that he's been cooped up in the palace too long and he wants to see the world. And despite his father's objections, out he goes. And it's said that on this journey he encountered 4 things. A person who was sick, a person who was, I'll say, decrepitly old, whose body had not survived aging well, a dead body with a family grieving around it. Those were the first 3, and with each one, he said to his charioteer, what is this? And the charioteer told him what it was, and Siddhartha was astonished and said, why does this happen? Well, it happens to everybody. You mean me? Yes, it's going to happen to you sometime. It's going to happen to everyone you know. It's going to happen to everything you love. The 4th person that the Buddha saw was a holy man. And when he asked about him, he was told that this was somebody who had dedicated their lives to trying to rid the world of pain and suffering. And since the Buddha was used to getting anything that his heart desired, he decided he was going to do that too, and he would get to the heart of the matter. And so, again, without his father's permission and leaving his wife and young child behind, Siddhartha went out, took off his princely robes, and became an ascetic. And he lived for, in some stories, 7 years with ascetic who practiced the most austere practices. He would balance on 1 foot for hours at a time, stand looking up at the sun during the hottest part of the Indian day. He would subsist on 1 grain of rice a day, trying to discipline his body. And eventually, he came to realize that that wasn't working. And he discovered what's called the middle path, which is a softer approach. And then after time spent meditating under the Bodhi tree, he had his enlightenment. And what he realized was succinctly codified in what's called the 4 Great Noble Truths. We've heard 2 of them. The first is life is dukkha, which, as Arthur said, is most often translated as suffering. Life is suffering. The 2nd noble truth is that suffering comes from craving and attaching. The 3rd noble truth is that there is a way out of suffering. And the 4th noble truth is that that way is the Eightfold Path of Buddhism. The Buddha came to be called the Great Doctor, and his teachings were said to be great medicine. And in these 4 Noble Truths, he acts like a doctor. First, he identifies the symptom. Life is suffering. Then he tries to diagnose what's the underlying illness. Suffering happens because of craving and attachment. Then, when doctors are always happy when they can do this, he turns to the patient and says, "I've got good news for you." And then he suggests the treatment, which is the Eightfold Path. The only thing he said he thought was dukkha and the cessation of dukkha. So, whenever I've been in conversations with non-Buddhists about Buddhism, one thing that comes up over and over and over again is exactly, again, what Arthur pointed to, that people say, wow, what a downer of a religious tradition. Life is suffering? That's the core of life? That's not true, I hope. So let's pull back and take a look at suffering. Because suffering in this context doesn't mean what most of us think of suffering. My son, my younger son, is 12. And he's going through this phase where everything is unfair. We tell him, "You've been on the Xbox for 4.5 hours. It's time to come off." "That's not fair," he screams. "You're the most unfair parents that ever were," etc. The term unsatisfactoriness, which is another translation for suffering, is really probably the most useful for us. Less, it thinks that it's not fair that something bad happens to him. Because admittedly, if you're in the middle of a good game of Halo 5, it's not a good thing to be told you have to stop. So it's bad. But then we add, "But it's not fair." And that's what really freaks him out. The bad thing is bad, but it's not fair. And we experience that all the time. Someone we love dies, or a relationship that we were so invested in crumbles. And that in itself is bad. That in itself causes pain. But then we add, "Why did it happen? It shouldn't have happened." That's suffering. That's unsatisfactoriness. And when the Buddha says that the cause of that suffering is, on the one hand, craving and attachment, what he's really saying is the way we live our lives, we either are craving, desiring, to stay with this month's theme, we're desiring something that we don't have, something that we think will make our lives better. Could be a material thing, could be a state of being, it could be not being sick, it could be not having a relative who's sick, it could be not having a kid who's complaining all the time that you're telling them to get off the Xbox, or vice versa, that you don't have a parent who's constant. It could be something like that, but we desire something that we don't have. Or we have something, and we desire to hold on to it. But nothing lasts forever. And so we are forced to let go of this thing we love. And either way, it's unsatisfying. I want what I don't have. I want to hold on to what I do. And neither one satisfies right now. That's a problem. And according to the Buddha, that's the problem. We want what we don't have, or we have, but we don't want to lose. And so he said that there is a way through that, and the way through that is to recognize that those things come and go. See, the thing that we want, that we desire, that we don't have, well, I'm not going to be happy until I have it. You know what I mean? You're in school and you're not really going to be happy until you graduate because school is hard. Then you graduate and you're not really going to be happy until you have a job because it's really hard living in your parents' basement. And then you get a job and you're not going to be happy until you get a better job because this job really stinks. And we're always saying we will be happy when, So we're attached to the idea of that thing that we don't yet have. It's that attachment. Or we have the thing we love, and we think that our happiness depends on it. So when we're forced to let go of it, forced to lose it, it's terrifying. It's depressing. It's suffering. So when we're faced with that reality, and it is, according to the Buddhist teachings, the reality of life, all things change, all things come and go, and that makes us unsatisfied. What about that cure? Where is that treatment plan that we're promised? And it has to do with understanding that reality and learning to let go of the things we're holding on to. See, the Buddha never said that desire is bad, because it's not. Desire in and of itself is just desire. In much the same way that St. Paul didn't say money is the root of all evil, he said the love of money is the root of all evil. And St. Ralph, Waldo Emerson, didn't say consistency is the hobgoblin of little minds. He said a foolish consistency is the hobgoblin of little minds. And so it's not desire per se, it's desire and attachment together. Desire and that sense that who we are depends on the fulfillment of that desire. That's the problem. If desire was a bad thing, we wouldn't know anything about all of this, because it was the Buddha's desire to find the solution to suffering that led him to realize that you have to let go of your desire. It takes a really strong desire to not desire. In fact, this is how long that desire held for the Buddha. It is said that he lived through many incarnations from the moment that he first had the inkling that he wanted Buddhahood. The story is that the Buddha of that era had passed by him with such peace radiating from him that he thought to himself, I want that. And the Buddha of that era looked at him and said, one day you will. And it said that many incarnations passed between that moment and his final attainment of it. Now, there's a concept called the Mahakalpa, which is a span of time. Way to describe it, if you think of a mountain as big as Mount Fuji, but a mile bigger in every direction, and then you imagine that every year, once a year, a bird flies by the mountain with a silk scarf in its beak, and that scarf passes by and brushes against the mountain. The mountain will be worn down to nothing in a mahakalpa. That's how long a mahakalpa is. Another way of looking at it, if you had a hole as big as the Grand Canyon, but a mile bigger in every direction, and a chipmunk were to run down to the bottom of it carrying a sesame seed and drop it there once a year, it would be one mahakalpa until it was filled to the brim. The stories say that from the moment the Buddha hatched the plan that he would be a Buddha, his desire for that stayed 100,000 mahakalpas. That, my friends, is strong desire. So desire isn't bad. It's that holding on to the desire. A couple of stories for you. There are a lot of Zen stories about letting go, about being present, about finding enough to be enough. One that I love, a monk came home one day, and when he came into his hut, he found that he was being robbed. Except the thief was kind of upset because there was nothing in the shack to rob. And the monk felt terrible that the thief was so upset, so he took off his clothes and said, here, please, steal these. Sort of confused, the thief took them and ran away. And the monk walked outside, sat down on the hill, looked up at the moon, And he said, "Oh, that poor thief. I wish I could have given him this moon. It's enough. It's enough." A story more close to home. Arthur actually told me the story as we were preparing for this. He was once at the Omega Institute at a workshop, and he had a room with a bathroom down the hall from it. And one of his friends was leaving early one morning, so he decided he wanted to get up early and go and say goodbye to his friend. So he got up, took a shower, went back to his room, and realized he had locked himself out of his room. Now, the windows were too high for him to climb into, and the front office where he could get a spare key was not going to be open for several hours, and his friend was leaving. So, wrapped in a towel, Arthur went to see his friend and say goodbye. His friend, noticing this, got a blanket and wrapped him in it so that he wasn't so open. They said goodbye to each other. Arthur sat on a bench and had what I can only call an epiphany. He said to himself, "I have too much. I have a blanket and a towel. I don't need both. Enough is enough. Enough is enough." Another story, that there's a man who is really, really, really suffering in his life. It just cannot find satisfaction, cannot find peace, cannot find happiness, and so he goes in search of happiness, peace, contentment. And he goes to doctors, and he goes to philosophers, and he goes to car mechanics, because who knows, maybe. He goes to libraries, and he reads them all the books he can find. He goes to comic book stores, and he's reading all the comics. He goes everywhere he can. Nothing. Nothing. But he hears about a wise woman who lives like in the farthest corner of the country. And people keep mentioning her, and so he decides he's going to make the trip. So he takes the long trip to get out there, gets himself a room in the town that's closest to this place, and he travels out to see the woman. And she asks him what he wants, and he says, "I want peace. I want to know how to live my life. I want to know what I can do to be happy." He says, "Well, I think I have the answer for you," she said. I think there's something I can give you that will make your life happy." And she went into her hut, and she came out with a diamond the size of his head. And she handed it to him and said, "Here, go sell this. You'll be happy." So he went back to the inn he was staying in. But he couldn't sleep at all. He was tossing and turning all night long. And the next morning, he took the diamond and he went back to the holy woman and he said, "This was a precious gift. But I realize what I really want you to give me is the secret to how you gave it away so easily. Enough. Enough." Now, there's a final story for this morning. And I have to introduce it by saying that preachers often say that our sermons aren't finished until you're done thinking about them. You know, I start the sermon here. But then in conversations you have with other people, or the way it bubbles up during the week, hopefully the way it comes back at some point, that's part of the sermon too. So my last story is your story. What is the thing that you think you need to be happy? Can you let go of that attachment to that desire? What is the thing you have that you don't think you can live without? Can you let go of that attachment to that desire? And what do you have right now that is already enough? Can you name that? When you can, answer those three questions, the sermon is over.